I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Dunbar, Senator Klayman, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Chair Giesel. On the phone is Senator Myers. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Kyla for helping us out recording the minutes of the meeting and helping us with the audio. The one subject today that we'll be hearing is Senate Bill 275, Natural Gas Projects, Income Tax, Surcharge. This is the second time that we've heard this bill, and we are hearing a presentation today, an analysis of the bill, from Nick Fulford, Senior Director, LNG and Energy Transition, Gaffney Klein. He is joined by Fernando Rolla, senior economist at Gaffney Klein. Committee members, also to let you know, online is Dan Stickle, chief economist, Tax Division, Department of Revenue, and Ben Boetker. I'm mispronouncing it. Sorry. Energy policy analyst, Cook Inlet Keepers, calling in as an interested party. So I'm also told that Matt Kissinger may be joining us at some point as well, possibly for questions. I'll let you know if he shows up. But Mr. Fulford, can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me, Chair Giesel?
Yes.
Good.
And we have your slides up on the screen for us and the public.
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Very briefly, with your permission, may I introduce Fernando Rolla. He's not been at any of these hearings before. He's one of the named individuals who's authorized to work on the business with the Alaska State, and he has just a very short introduction.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Fernando Rolla. I'm a senior economist with Gaffney Klein. I have 25 years in oil and gas industry, six of them with Gaffney Klein. My work includes LNG global projects. Among them, the export plan for LNG exports here in Argentina. I am relatively new to this Alaska project, but I appreciate the opportunity to contribute with this committee work. Thank you.
Very good. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Fernando. So with that, Chair Giesel, we can make a start and get straight into the slides with your permission.
That would be grand. Thank you, Nick.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we have a basis of opinion slide, which I think people have seen before, which I'll skip over very quickly. But obviously, it's important to convey exactly the nature of our work and how we do it, and particularly the sort of objectivity and independence of our advice. But with that, if we can move to the agenda slide, we can talk about that for a few moments. So, a couple of things, really. First of all, today's discussion isn't primarily to talk about market conditions, but I think so much has happened over the last couple of weeks, some of which may have significant implications for the project in Alaska, that it is appropriate to start off with a little bit of background about what's happening, how it's affecting prices, and how it might affect the particularly buyers' views towards the project in Alaska. Second, I wanted to move on to project structure. Chair Giesel, I think on Friday's hearing, you provided a helpful summary of the rationale for the bill and the changes which have taken place over the last 10 or 12 years since SB 138 was put together. So what we wanted to do is just sort of dwell on some of those changes and how they affect the structuring of the project, and perhaps more importantly, how they determine how revenues fall into different segments within the project, and how the tax treatment between those parts of the project can vary. So So that, I think, will address some of the other questions which came up on Friday, namely, how do you place a value on the gas on the North Slope and how might that be taxed? So related to that is the question about transparency and economic evaluations. As I think most people, certainly on the committee, are aware, the SP 138 process involved quite extensive economic modeling facet to it, which involved certain parties within the state subject to very strict confidentiality rules. And clearly that's something which is used more widely in the industry to really give substance to some of these discussions between host governments and LNG projects on the appropriateness of fiscal arrangements. I'll give a couple of examples, including Canada, and then more widely in the world as to how that can typically be dealt with. From that, we wanted to move on to talk about the actual surcharge proposal, the 15 cents, how it fits into the project more generally, and really how it might affect some of the outcomes. And then finally, we wanted to talk about the really the lease operating expense changes or exclusions and how they might affect how the project is seen. Two facets of this, really. One relates to the gas processing plant, which itself is an extremely complex element to the project. And that's what we wanted to focus on today, just to introduce some of those concerns or considerations. Obviously, the lease operating expense topic more generally applies to a range of oil and gas fields on the slope. And I think the a proper analysis on the implications of those lease operating expense changes on those specific fields would be quite detailed and probably outside the scope of what we planned today. So unless there are any questions on that agenda, I would propose we move straight to slide five.
All right, slide five.
Thank you. So clearly everyone's been, I'm sure, following the news and developments in the Middle East. Interestingly, a lot of the news focus has been on the oil restrictions which are being created by the lack of traffic through the Straits of Hormuz. I think it would be true to say that the bigger story and perhaps the longer lasting story might actually relate to gas and specifically LNG. Just to put things into context, about 14% of global gas supplies are delivered in the form of LNG. And around 20% of that comes from Qatar primarily. So effectively, the loss of the Qatari supplies as a result of the stoppage in shipping through the Straits of Hormuz, it's effectively removed about 3% from global gas supplies. But of course, many countries rely entirely on LNG. Some others obviously can substitute using pipeline gas. But nonetheless, the removal of such a huge quantity of LNG from the market has had very significant ramifications in terms of pricing and market. India and Pakistan, for example, rely very heavily on Qatari LNG. And they're experiencing gas cutbacks for many of their key industries, and the effect on their economies is already quite substantial. I should add that, not on the slide, but developments earlier today, there's been some additional activity in the Ras Laffan complex in Qatar. It's been seemingly hit by missiles and has experienced some damage. So I think already what we're seeing is an assumption that the effect on LNG market will be longer and more significant than perhaps might have been thought a few days ago. So if I can move to the next slide. The events in the Middle East are by no means the only risks and outcomes which have been affecting the LNG market more recently. For example, the Suez Canal typically, you know, has taken several hundred LNG carriers per year. There have been no transits of the Suez Canal since January 2024 because of the security issues there. The Panama Canal has also been affected by drought. It's not a conflict, but it's a drought issue which has cut back significantly on the number of carriers coming through. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, a Russian LNG carrier was effectively destroyed in the Mediterranean. It was part of the so-called shadow fleet, which I'm sure many people are aware of. That incident, in fact, was linked with the Ukrainian conflict, not the one in the Middle East. But nevertheless, it's the first time ever that an LNG carrier has experienced anything like that. So you may say, well, you know, how does this affect Alaska, given that we're talking about first gas many years from now? But I think, you know, for many of these economies that are affected, which, you know, would include those countries I've mentioned, but, you know, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, in fact, most of the Asian economies, they tend to take a very long view of their LNG procurement strategies, and they do think quite deeply about the effect on the economy of supply disruptions and so forth. So I think inevitably, you know, as the implications of what's happened over the last few weeks and potentially in the next few months starts to sink in, I would imagine that there could be quite a significant uptick in interest in LNG from Alaska, and it could translate into, you know, potentially a much more active dialogue on the project. So if we're going to move to the final slide dealing with these market conditions, just a reminder that it is just 9 days sailing from Alaska to most of the key Asian markets. There aren't any navigational hazards or risks to speak of. And, you know, as many of these big Asian buyers, many of whom are linked with the host governments, start to consider how to cope with this new world that we seem to be in. You know, one could even see premium prices and that sort of thing being paid. So obviously it's a rapidly evolving situation. It's too early to say what the lasting effects will be, but I think we know enough already to say that it could have quite a significant effect on the desirability of LNG from Alaska. So with that, subject to any questions, I would move on to the next section.
Mr. Fulford, Senator Kawasaki has a question.
Thank you. And you sort of pointed it out in the last slide in bullet number three. But, you know, Alaska, we're not at war. Alaska, we're not going to have pirates in the Cook Inlet region. We've got a lot of things going for us that the LNG disruptions that we've seen, I mean, this has happened a lot. I mean, so it seems like this is a premium market. And with that, I just had a question about, so the price in Alaska, when we try and value our natural gas, it seems like it should be a premium, right?
Certainly through the chair, I think Senator Kawasaki. There's a supply diversity premium, which is difficult to quantify, but which would be taken account in terms of, you know, a buying strategy. But I think the other way to look at it is that the premium, if you like, which can be paid for Alaskan LNG, a lot of that premium is kind of spoken for because of the cost and complexity of the project itself. So, you know, we know that it's a very costly project in terms of capital investment. But as factors we'll see later on in the discussion, the economics are certainly within a sort of a feasible band, put it that way. I don't know if that answers your question.
Follow up, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, it did. And just to follow up, LNG is based on like there's oil, different oil markets in different regions of the world. Would this be its own region of the world if Alaska were to become a natural gas, an LNG producer? Would it be like, we have Alaska North Slope crude, it's priced very differently than West Texas Intermediate, but even though most of it gets sold south of Alaska?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. I think even in the last 10 years, we've seen LNG markets become a lot more sophisticated than they ever used to be. And part of that has been the entry of the US in such a big way into the market, which has sort of brought with it a much more sort of commercially flexible approach with many more sort of trading options. So already, in some ways, there's a kind of a US Gulf Coast LNG pricing hub that you could think of as sort of emerging. So with Alaska, with LNG Canada, with Xelisims and Cedar LNG, and some of the other projects that exist in the Pacific Northwest, you could imagine in some years to come a kind of Pacific Northwest LNG hub developing, which could be used for trading purposes. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibilities, but it's not quite that mature like oil is at the moment.
And just
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just final question. We used to export gas from the Cook Inlet region directly to Japan. ConocoPhillips was one of the most recent that used to on an export license up until 2012 or 2014. How was that price set?
Thank you for the question. And through the chair, I have some distant involvement with that project because of the shipping. And it may interest you to know that the delivered price of that gas was 60 cents per MMBTU. And it was effectively the result of a kind of government-to-government dialogue. And the other feature of that supply contract is that it had a most favored nations clause. So, for example, when Brunei started exporting LNG soon after the project in Nikiski, the agreement was that the Bruneian gas would be priced at exactly the same level. That was the deal with the Japanese government. So in those days, it was a very different environment.
Thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the factors that make Alaska appealing for natural gas, the stability versus some of the other parts of the world, seem to also apply to our oil market. The price of oil is also rising, has risen very significantly. There was always a challenge on the North Slope. The gas is used through reinjection to increase our oil output. If the price of oil remains high, will it disincentivize some of the producers from selling natural gas? Or has the price of gas risen enough that it still makes good financial sense for them? And there was some talk about Glenfarne already having not contracts, but something like contracts with the potential producers on the North Slope of gas. How high would oil have to go before they start rethinking those commitments to Glenfarne?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar, and through the chair. I think there are probably some shorter term implications and some longer term ones involved in your question. Certainly what we're seeing with the oil market is a relatively short term spike. The futures market is assuming that things will return to normal after a period of months. Gas, not so much, and we'll come on to talk about that. But the relative economics of oil and gas on the slope, this is one of the pivotal parts of this entire project, because it will, for example, influence, as you pointed out, the price at which producers are willing to sell gas into the LNG project versus having to either accept lower oil production or look at different means to do so. I don't want to kind of jump to the end of the presentation, but one of the considerations is that with the CO2 removal plant being part of the LNG project, producers could conceivably substitute gas injection with CO2 injection. Technically, it's a very different operation. But in terms of sustaining oil production on the slope, using CO2 to do that instead of gas could be, you know, a significant part of the sort of forward plan.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar?
Yeah, just very briefly. So the question I asked that perhaps is impossible to answer is, how high would oil have to go before the producers reimagined their commitments to Glenfarne? And I think what I heard you say is it might just alter the price at which they're willing to sell the gas, but likely wouldn't cause them to stop selling gas into the LNG pipeline. Is that what you're saying?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar, and through the chair. That's not a bad summary, but what I would suggest is that we have two or three slides further on in the presentation which kind of speak to this point in quite a bit of detail, because we kind of discuss really the sort of gas producers' motivations and dynamics around how that contract might end up looking. As you say, it's been reported in the press that preliminary agreements have been discussed, but obviously the devil is in the detail, and there are many, many ways in which you could formulate that contract, some of which we describe in our slides.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So through the chair, I was wondering, we're getting a media report that an Iranian missile strikes have just blown up Ras Laffan in Qatar and destroyed it. And I'm looking at the other list of stuff that you have here. Can we build this pipeline fast enough? And how is this going to affect our share of oil going out onto the market? Is it getting more valuable by the minute?
Thank you, Senator Rauscher, through the chair. Yes, I made an oblique reference to that missile attack on Ras Laffan. Perhaps I should have made it more explicit. But yes, you know, news reports earlier today. Just for the committee's sort of broader understanding, Ras Laffan occupies just a few square miles of Qatar, but it contains the roughly the same LNG export capacity that exists in the entire the US. So it's about 80 million tons of capacity in that very small area. It's being expanded up to over 120 million tons. And in fact, they had hoped to be commissioning that new liquefaction very soon. Just physically, it is an extremely vulnerable piece of land. And you could imagine that quite some damage could have occurred, you know, given how compact it all is. So, yes, it will. I think oil has gone up again today. Gas has certainly gone up, and there's now an expectation that the market will have to do without Qatari LNG for several months at least. which, you know, is putting pressure on prices. But I think as we come to talk about the net back and the market prices and how it all affects the economics of oil and gas production in Alaska, I think it will help to put some of this into context.
Follow up, Senator Rocher.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just, but it seems like it would, doesn't it? I mean, it's hard to predict, but I also understand it seems like it would drastically affect it, but that's just me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I see no further questions, Mr. Fulford. I'll let you move on to slide number 9.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, really on slide number 9, I think we come back to your own summary from Friday of how things have moved on since the days of SB 138 and what was in essence a fully integrated project which involved a commercial alignment between the state and the three gas producers right from the wellhead right down to putting LNG on the ships. So what we've now got is the layout on the right, where the gas production is subject to upstream tax and royalty mechanisms. The impact on oil taxes is now potentially isolated through SB 275 and the lease operating expense terms. So we've now got a fairly straightforward approach to evaluating the upstream tax that would be payable. And then we've got these three project modules, which under SB 275, again, will have a very clear taxation treatment based on, you know, the standard 9.4% state corporate income tax, subject to all the suitable deductions and so forth. But and as we look at that, the three blocks on the right there, the gas processing plant, gas transmission pipeline, liquefaction plant, based on high level economics, you have the three major investments which would generate of the order of about $500 million in state corporate income tax in year one and around $1.5 billion in year 20. So obviously, you know, there's a significant potential for corporate income tax there. But the bigger question arises, well, what would be the upstream tax payable on this gas? And in fact, how much is it worth? You know, what's the value of gas on the North Slope, which I think was exactly one of the questions that came up on Friday. So in order to address these questions and to put some illustrative framework around it, the first thing you really have to do is to put down some illustrative economics. So if I may move to the next slide, we can start to talk about how we've gone about that and what the implications would be. But I'll pause for any questions.
I see no questions, Mr. Fulford. Oh, pardon me. Senator Rocher has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So under this slide here, I see you're under SB 38.
Slide 9, is that correct?
Yeah, slide 9.
The previous slide.
Yeah, the previous one before we left.
There we go.
So the line just points to the left side. Was it supposed to point to both sides? Is it talking equally there? Or where do we differentiate those for me one more time?
Yes, thank you, Senator Rauscher, and through the chair, it'd be good to clarify. The significance of the red box around the left-hand side is really symbolizing the integrated nature of the project that existed under SB 138. So it was an alignment of commercial and equity interests, which went all the way from the wellhead through the processing plant, the transmission line, and down to the liquefaction facility. And the key thing that that removed was the need to address a transfer price from the production entity into the LNG project, because one of the advantages of the SB138 structure was that essentially it was all captured in the alignment mechanism that governed the project. So the concept we have now effectively divides the project into two. You've got the midstream infrastructure, if I can call it that, in the three blue boxes, light, dark blue boxes, and then you've got the upstream element in the light blue, which is subject to completely different tax considerations. So that was really, I hope that helps to clarify.
Follow-up, Senator Rusher?
Thank you.
All right. We can move on then to slide 10.
Okay. So before we get into this in too much detail, you know, I just need to emphasize that these are purely illustrative numbers. We have no insight into the project. But as I mentioned earlier, in order to illustrate how some of the cash flows might work and how they might feed through to the value of gas on the slope, you kind of have to start somewhere. And so this is our sort of way to create an illustrative framework to have those other discussions. So what we did here was for the purpose of this exercise, we said, okay, well, let's take a capital value of $25 billion for the liquefaction plant. That comes out as about $1,250 per ton per annum. So that's a significant uplift on what you'd be paying for the Gulf, but you know, in line with, I think, what's been said generally about the project here in Alaska. Cost of the pipeline, including compression, of $15 billion. Cost of gas processing and CO2 removal, $10 billion. We've rounded the cost of shipping up to a dollar. Come back and talk about that. But we've assumed that each of those elements in the value chain would generate a return of about 10% post-tax. And for the tax framework that we've applied, we've used 9.4% state corporate income tax and 21% federal. So by using all those assumptions and bearing in mind that we're not, and by the way, this includes property tax at the current rate, we've looked at what the levelized cost of each element in the chain would be. So in other words, this is the income that the midstream owners would have to secure in order to generate that 10% post-tax return that we've set. So rounded to the nearest dollar, it comes to about $5 for liquefaction, $2 for gas transmission, $3 for gas processing, and as I say, for the purpose of the exercise, we rounded shipping to a dollar. So that all adds up to $11 an MMBTU. And, you know, I think the way to look at that is that it's a kind of a bare bones economic analysis, could be viewed as a very high case. And as you look at ways of reducing that levelized cost across the chain, for example, the property tax reduction, you know, using the 45Q credits on the CO2, looking at market-related shipping, potential sale of CO2 for enhanced oil recovery, and crucially, a capital structure based on probably 70% debt. You can get what I would describe as a line of sight to about a $3 reduction. And I would venture to suggest that, you know, Glenfarne are probably doing exactly this now. They're looking at ways to get that levelized cost down. They're looking at different capital structures to allow them to do that. They're looking at, no doubt, federal loan guarantees and things of that sort. But for the purposes of the question, how much is the gas worth on the slope? It's a useful approach. I think everyone on the committee will probably remember the WoodMac report from 2022. Obviously, a different set of capital assumptions, so naturally a lower number. Different assumptions, which obviously weren't part of the report. But anyway, the number that WoodMac had for the same analysis was $5.56. So, as I say, in order to furnish the discussion on economics and value, we've used this approach for now, obviously subject to what I'm sure will be much more detailed discussion, particularly if and when some kind of joint economic model might be shared by the developers. So if there aren't any questions on that, I'll move on to how we've used it.
I'm seeing no questions.
Okay. So so let's turn to this question of what's the gas worth on the North Slope? And so this graph that you're seeing here in front of you, the thin dotted red line at the top is prevailing Asian LNG prices. It's essentially the market that Alaska Gas would aim to supply. And what we've done is we've then deducted the levelized cost numbers from that. So in other words, it's, well, if you can secure that price for the gas when it's delivered, if you take off all the costs of getting it there and liquefying it, what are you left with at the wellhead? So the blue line represents the net back value to the North Slope if you use the WoodMac number. The green one represents the $8 levelized cost assumption. And the orange line represents the $11 cost assumption. And you'll notice that the essentially the first line up on that graph represents the zero. So what you can conclude from that is that if we were to use the WoodMac number, the value of gas at the point of production it has been as high as $10, but lately it's been around $5. Using the $8 number, it's been up to $5, but it's probably more recently been $2. And if you use the $11 number, you can see that for the last 6 months or so, the value of the gas on the slope would have been about zero or slightly negative. I've got a little red balloon on that graph, simply to bring your attention to really what LNG prices have been doing over the last 6 months, 12 months. And what we've been seeing is a slow decline in prices where essentially supply has exceeded demand. And much of that, if not all of it, has been due to the additional liquefaction trains being commissioned in Texas and Louisiana. And, you know, a relatively significant wave of new LNG that's been coming from the Gulf Coast. So that's an interesting feature there. So if we then turn to what gas prices are doing today, it's difficult to see behind the lines, but based on what I was saying at the start of the presentation, there has been this tremendous shock to gas prices, and the forward curve now that is being traded upon is now, you know, prices in the sort of $20, even $25 range. I mean, I think even today it went up again. So of course, if you use those same deductions to get to remove the levelized cost from the landed price, then obviously it completely changes the perspective of what that gas is worth on the North Slope. So we're now looking at you know, pretty well $15 an MMBTU based on the WoodMac number, around about $10 using the $8, and around about five using the much higher $11 number. And that prevails over the next year or so, with a gradual stabilization around 2028. So, of course, you know, forward prices don't mean a lot. It's just the market expectation and where people are willing to trade. But that's what things look like today. So the next slide, subject to any questions.
Yes, before you go on, Nick, if you could just pause for a moment. I know that Senator Myers had a question. Senator Myers, we just finished looking at slide 12, by the way. Senator Myers?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Fulford, when the WoodMac study was being presented to us at the beginning of last year, they were making assumptions that the value of gas at the wellhead was about $1 to $1.25, if I remember right. Is this the type of analysis that they were likely doing to come up with that number?
Thank you, Senator Myers, and through the chair. My understanding of that description was not so much what the gas was necessarily worth on the slope. It was more the market intelligence, call it what you will, the indications from those closest to the project as to what they were aspiring to secure as a sort of a rough price in order to make the economics of the project work. So I'm sure WoodMac, you know, perfectly capable of doing the same analysis that we've just been talking about. But I think the sort of directional message with that was that's what we expect to sign a contract for. And it could be that AGDC or others could comment on that.
Fill me in, Mr. Fulford. You're asking AGDC to answer that question?
Well, I think they would be better placed to characterize the dollar or $1.25 that was mentioned in the more recent WoodMac report in terms of whether it's WoodMac's perceived value of the gas or the netback, if you like, on the slope, or whether it's a reflection of indicative contract discussions that were happening at the time.
Matt Kissinger is online. He is the commercial manager for AGDC. Mr. Kissinger, did you hear the subject that Mr. Fulford was discussing?
Yeah. Chair Diesel, yes, I understand. I heard the question. So that $1.25 back in 2022 was an input that we were provided to WoodMac on the basis of the conversations that we'd had with the producers up until that point. So it was where we viewed the likely negotiations would result in.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you explain, Mr. Fulford, explain this number a little bit more to me, what we're looking at, historical netback. So from 2015 to 2020, it's a negative. At the higher cost, it's negative 388. At the netback lower cost, it's looks like negative 88 cents. What does that mean for the state treasury? Like, what is that? Is it the netback? Is that what we're basing our taxes on? Is that, explain what we're looking at here with netback.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, and through the chair. Yes, you've interpreted the numbers exactly right. And I think this is a good segue actually into these next set of slides, because if the LNG framework was being negotiated such that the North Slope gas producers were the only entity taking price risk on the ultimate sale, then they would be making a loss. And the input to the state would be, you know, correspondingly zero. But that assumes that they would be paying some kind of fee to the LNG producers, where the state would be in receipt of corporate income tax. So as I say, I think the next few slides will probably put this into context. But it is interesting to note that what I would describe as the sort of weakest pricing period in sort of recent history from, you know, 2015 to 2020, which was a particularly low pricing environment, then the Alaska LNG project potentially would have struggled to have got going in that era because of, you know, these netbacks. As you can see, if the Wood Mac levelized cost number is applied, you do still get a small positive number. I think, you know, perhaps more helpfully, if you look at the last 10 years from 2016 to 2026, which obviously includes the European supply disruptions, which will have pushed the average up a bit, you have an average Asian gas price of $12.26, which would indicate a value on the slope of between $1.26 and $6.70.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Just a comment, but the numbers concern me because, I mean, you're basically hoping for a war or disruption somewhere. Otherwise, you got a lot of negative numbers here. Is that fair to say?
Thank you for the question, Senator Wilikowski. I think through the chair, as with oil prices, you know, gas prices can be quite volatile. And actually, I should make a very important point at this juncture, which is that although looking at spot prices is a convenient way to evaluate economics, the reality is that you certainly a project of this scale, you wouldn't sell gas purely indexed on Asian prices. You might sell some of it, for example, indexed to oil. And these days, certainly hybrid contracts are much more popular, where buyers and sellers are looking at a basket of indexation mechanisms to avoid these kind of very volatile changes. So, but, you know, I think, you know, you're quite right that if you look at the last, what's that, almost 20 years of 15 of LNG pricings, there have been periods where the profitability of the Alaska project could have been quite high and periods where it might not have been. And this is where the way in which financial risk falls is such a key feature. And I think as we go through the next three slides, we've got some illustrations that will perhaps help understand that a bit more.
All right. Why don't we go on to slide 13?
Okay. So, so given that backdrop and given the comments there from Senator Wilikowski, you know, there are a number of ways in which a gas producer could approach this question of selling gas into the AKLNG project. And obviously, we have absolutely no line of sight into this dialogue and how this contractual discussion is evolving. But, you know, theoretically, there are a number of ways in which it could evolve. One option would be for the gas producers to say, okay, well, we're going to sell our gas at a dollar or $1.25, and we're going to index it to some kind of inflationary measure such that we have a steady revenue of, you know, whatever it might be, over many years to come. Then it would be up to the LNG company to essentially manage all those price fluctuations and volatility, which we've just been talking about. So, in effect, the volatility in tax income that the state would experience would be in the 9.4% corporate income tax, but the upstream gross gas tax would remain pretty well unchanged year in, year out. So a lot of this hinges on the stakeholders and investors in the different parts of the chain and their appetite to take global gas price risk. But this is one way you could do it.
I see no questions.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So on slide 14, we move on to effectively the next way in which this could be done. And that is, it's a relatively common practice in the industry. You could adopt what's called a net back pricing mechanism. So instead of taking a fixed price, you could take some degree of market risk and say, okay, well, whatever the gas is sold for, some percentage of it, so just in this example, say 15% of the ultimate sales price flows back to the gas producer. The effect of that is that obviously upstream tax and corporate income tax would both become variable for the state. But the one difference between the previous example and this one is that in times of higher prices, or if you assume that LNG prices will rise over time, effectively more of that revenue and value will feed into the upstream, and the benefit to the state will be proportionally higher because of the higher tax take in the upstream compared to the midstream. So although the state would be taking a degree of price risk in its kind of upstream tax revenues, it would also benefit proportionally more from a higher price gas market.
Senator Wilikowski.
I'm not sure if this is the right time to ask this question, but the scenario that we're dealing with, as you know, we have a very likely scenario where gas will be sold at probably very low prices upstream at maybe a dollar an MCF into the pipeline, and then be sold after it's processed into the ultimate buyer for maybe $20-$25. And the way our current tax structure is we're taxing it at the dollar. And so I'm curious what advice you have for us to try to capture a fair value for our gas in that situation.
Yes, thank you, Senator Wilikowski, and through the chair. I think if I conclude with slide 15, which is really the last kind of scenario that I wanted to describe, that will put some of this into context as well. So the third basic option facing the gas producers and indeed the LNG project would be to potentially move to what's typically termed a tolling mechanism. Now, fair to say that this structure, I don't think, has been talked about by Glenfarne or AGDC, but it does remain an option, I would imagine, at this point in the project definition. It's a structure that upstream producers and those entities who are comfortable taking downstream LNG pricing risk sometimes prefer. And it would involve essentially paying a flat fee to the LNG company for the gas treatment, the gas transportation, and the liquefaction. And in effect, it means that the gas producers would give their gas to the LNG company, who would give them back LNG and put it on the ship, and everything downstream of that, including the LNG marketing and so forth, would be essentially managed by the upstream producer. It's fair to say that there are some projects, such as Cameron LNG down in the Gulf Coast, where they kind of mix and match these structures. So some of their production is tolling based, and some of it is sale and purchase agreements. So, you know, it is possible to kind of blend some of these structures depending on the preferences of the parties involved. But with this structure, coming back to your question, Senator Wilkowski, with this structure, effectively, you wouldn't be taxing at the dollar anymore. You could potentially be taxing at whatever that netback is, which, as you've seen from the previous slides, could be multiple dollars depending on where the market ends up. So in an environment where you believe that LNG markets are, you know, demand is accelerating, supply is still hard to come by, you know, this tax structure would probably result in the greatest tax revenue for the state.
Mr. Fulford, Senator Myers had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Fulford, if I'm understanding these three slides correctly, 13, 14, and 15, effectively what you're saying with these three is the state is getting its money both from the royalty of the gas and then from the production tax and the producers and then corporate income tax on the owners of the line and then liquefaction plant. But in the bill before us, we're talking about potentially a larger ownership share of the pipe and processing facilities for the state. How does that affect both the risk to the state and the potential revenues to the state in these three models?
That's an excellent question, Senator Myers, and through the chair. You know, coming back to discuss that. So under the first model, with a relatively low cost, shall we say, transfer of gas into the project, the profitability of the project could be quite variable, depending on, you know, how high the gas is priced. And so with an equity interest in the project, obviously the, you know, the revenues could be potentially very attractive for the state as an equity holder. That would be moderated somewhat by the second structure, whereby profitability in the midstream, in the LNG company, would transfer up to the gas producers to some extent. So the state would lose out potentially in terms of its dividends on an equity interest in the midstream, but would potentially benefit from higher taxation in the upstream. And then with the last one, the creditworthiness of the upstream producer could be a significant factor, because as we've seen in some of the US projects, once these tolling agreements are entered into, no matter what happens with the market, it's like a take or pay contract. You pay to process the gas, and whatever happens in the market, the LNG company continues to receive its tolling fee. So in that environment, the state arguably could be exposed to some credit risk through the upstream producers losing money in a bad market. But more generally, it would be looking at a very steady, predictable equity revenues and equally steady, predictable corporate income tax.
Follow-up, Senator Myers?
Just to summarize, to make sure I understood Mr. Fulford correctly, effectively what you're saying is that in each of these three scenarios, as we take a larger equity stake in the pipe, we do have a higher potential revenue coming back to the state, but where our risk comes in changes whether it it gets altered, whether it's coming from the revenues from the pipe or whether it's coming from the revenues from the producers on the slope. But I'm kind of hearing that overall, we're still in roughly the same position, regardless of which of these three models that we're in. Is that accurate?
Thank you, Senator Myers. Thanks for the chair. Yeah, that's a good summary. So much revolves around the appetite within the state to accept, you know, gas price risk in global markets, and the way the upside is shared. This is a very common question in global LNG projects. It's particularly with host governments who have a equity stakeholding in the LNG project. There's typically a lot of discussion about how upside and downside are handled, and sometimes it can vary. So, for example, if the state is concerned about balancing its budget and securing a certain minimum revenue from the project, it may choose to sacrifice some of the potential upside when prices are very high and give that back to some of the oil and gas companies involved, such that the state manages its financial exposure within certain bounds. So that would be a very typical dialogue and negotiation between a host government and an LNG project.
Follow-up, Senator Myers?
No, thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on how we could structure a system so that we don't get gamed. And I'm worried that on the one hand, if we tax the upstream and we get royalties at the upstream, as you said, a company could literally give away its gas and just pay the tariff and we get nothing. We get no royalties. We get very little, if any, taxes. And then they pick it up on the downstream and ship it, sell it for $25. We get very little, if anything. Maybe some corporate income taxes. I'm curious your thoughts on that. You said that other states and jurisdictions wrestle with this issue, and I'd be curious how other states and jurisdictions handle that, where they are in a similar situation as we are, where we have such high costs to ship the gas, to get the gas to market.
That's an excellent question, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. I think it is probably something we should discuss in more detail at a subsequent hearing. But certainly, as you say, there are many mechanisms that apply globally in order to make sure that the state is getting its fair share. I'll just give you one example. In Australia, the ore industry, iron ore and copper and so forth, were able to put quite a lot of value offshore by, for example, using a trading company. And so when it came to LNG, obviously, you know, high levels of government were keen to make sure that appropriate taxes were being paid. So in that instance, the tax authority had quite a lot of ability to examine what was going on between the various contracts and make sure that appropriate value was being left in Australia. So that's just an example of an agency that has sufficiently wide powers to intervene in some of these things and take action accordingly. So, you know, there are many similar approaches like that, but and it's probably a good segue also into the next section about transparency, because of course many of these issues around gaming and understanding where the value is and where the tax is being paid, it rests around some degree of insight into the project.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski. I see no other questions, but that was a very profound statement you just made, Mr. Fulford. Thank you. I think we're ready to move on to slide 17, if you're ready, Mr. Fulford.
Yes, and I think obviously, you know, this has been a topic that, i.e., transparency and potential access to project economics, it's been an issue which has been discussed, I think, at previous hearings, and I've made mention before of open book economic models of the sort that were used under SB 138 to establish appropriate equity along the chain. So I've taken this a step further and said, okay, well, let's look at some specific examples of where a more collaborative, transparent environment arose, which enabled governments to establish a suitable base. So I think, you've often heard me talk about LNG Canada because it is, I think, in so many ways, a great learning example for where things are at here in Alaska. So British Columbia, as you know, they struggled with tax and fiscal treatment. They introduced a special LNG tax and so forth, and it went back and forth. And the one of the significant features which enabled that dialogue to be unlocked and a series of fiscal measures to be agreed was the establishment of a joint economic model, which was developed with the project leader Shell. And it was used to look at the value of different fiscal measures, such as tax deferrals. And most significantly, it was used to arrive at the natural gas credit mechanism, which was established for the project. And so that's a really good example of where the open book model, or the joint economic model, as they called it, enabled a dialogue between government and host government and project developer to arrive at a set of fiscal measures that were considered acceptable by both sides. So as I say, it's just a good example. And on the next page, on slide 18, are a number of other examples around the world, which there's a lot of detail on this slide and people can read it at their leisure. But the way I think I would characterize this slide is if you look at the projects and the locations down that left-hand column, they are all resource-rich economies where the impact of a single LNG project has a fundamental effect on the host government's economy. So unlike, Texas, Louisiana, et cetera, where, as we've discussed before, the addition of one extra LNG project makes very little difference to the overall state economy, Alaska has much more in common with many of those jurisdictions on the left, where, the reverse is true, that the project has this fundamental effect on state revenues, on jobs, employment, cost of energy, and so forth. So what you see is a good correlation between that type of environment and where these open book economic models or collaborative models are used. The last comment to the end, the life cycle point is an interesting one too, because it suggests that these models are often of most use in the lead up to FEED and FID, as the project economics are coming together. And interestingly, also in that top example in Tanzania, part of that economic model also included a so-called domestic market obligation. So in some ways, there's a parallel there between, what's being discussed here with the gas pipeline and what was being done there with domestic market. So as I say, just a number of other examples here where the existence of that open book economic model has been relied upon. Obviously, in some of these, you know, Tanzania, Mozambique, equity by host government was discussed. But of course, you know, here in Alaska, even though a decision to place equity in the project hasn't yet been agreed or debated, even evaluating whether an equity participation in the project is appropriate obviously requires that kind of level of insight, and whether that's through AGDC or some other mechanism is up to the state to decide.
So I have some questions here on slide 18. I'm starting with Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Do you think that our current laws are written in a way to protect the state's economic interests? Or do you think there needs to be an evaluation and some possible changes?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Very, very broad question there. So through the chair, you know, I think that there are two main drivers for a debate and discussion around fiscal and legislative frameworks that apply to LNG projects. The first bucket, if you like, is features which enable the project to successfully pass through FID and become a reality. The second set is where, particularly as here in Alaska, there is the constitutional obligation to ensure resources are being properly monetized, is to say, well, you know, the current legislative arrangements aren't sufficiently detailed or relevant to a project of this sheer scale and nature that, you know, some review needs to be done. You know, the phrase enabling legislation has come up a few times, and I think it was mentioned the other day in Juneau. And, you know, the question is, well, what does enabling legislation look like? And as we get down into the detail, for example, those three slides I put up in terms of how the gas is structured, the degree of price risk that the state wishes to take, you very quickly get into a very, very detailed fiscal framework in order to address the needs of both the state and the equity investors. So I think the answer is I would expect a fairly significant reappraisal of the legislative framework that the state has in order to make sure it's fit for purpose for the LNG project.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Are you aware of any proposals by the executive branch to engage in that reappraisal to ensure that Alaskans' interests are being protected?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. I'm not aware of any dialogue of that sort. I think, you know, one of the questions is at what stage in the project is it appropriate to have that discussion? And we seem to be, you know, the project appears to be advancing, and probably we're getting closer to that point. But that's for many of the stakeholders to consider.
Senator Wilikowski.
Does it seem odd to you that the governments of Tanzania, Indonesia, Mozambique, Papua New Guinea, Senegal, Mauritania, Trinidad and Tobago, all engaged in this seemingly high-level negotiations with industry, and here we are 60 days almost into our 120-day session, and we have nothing from our executive branch that would seemingly protect the state of Alaska's economic interest?
Yeah, I think Senator Wilikowski, I'm probably not best qualified to answer that question.
All right, next up, I'm going to go to Senator Myers. We're on slide 18, Senator Myers.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Fulford, looking at the countries listed on slide 18, first off, I'm wondering if you might be able to provide the committee with what the ownership stake of each sovereign was in each of those projects, and maybe even for the Canadian project referenced in the previous slide. And then second, I was wondering if you have seen a trend in between information sharing and how much of an equity stake is taken by the sovereign in each of these cases.
Thank you, Senator Meisen, through the chair. Canada is an interesting case because British Columbia never really had any aspiration and were never invited to be part of the LNG Canada project. So the fact that this joint economic model was developed in order to help the BC government arrive at an appropriate fiscal conclusion is probably all the more significant because there was no equity stake. But with some of these others, I mean, the typical host government equity stake in an LNG project can be 10 to 15%. Sometimes that equity stake is carried by the other stakeholders in the project and paid for from future revenues. But yeah, 10 to 15% might be an appropriate stake. And it also partly depends whether a state oil or gas company has been established, because typically the government equity stake would be through the state oil or gas company.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Senator Myers?
No, thank you.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Both the page 17 and page 18, all these different companies that have projects, were all of them publicly traded companies?
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Through the chair. Well, certainly all the ones on the left there involve project leaders that are publicly traded. And of course, LNG Canada was led by Shell. So same answer.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
So one of the things that has struck me about the project we're trying to vet here in the Resource Committee is the almost complete lack of any meaningful information about what it looks like from an economic perspective. In all these projects that you're showing us, did the host government have substantially more economic information about the pipeline projects than we have today?
Yes, I think Senator Klayman, through the chair, through the frameworks that are summarized on this page, on page 18, most of them would involve something akin to a complex Excel model, which would enable the parties to simulate or model different types of economic performance. One thing they typically don't include is price assumptions. So, for example, most of those companies listed on the left there, they all have their own confidential sort of pricing forecasts and views on how things will develop. So they would leave it up to the host government to put in their own assumptions and, arrive at their own conclusions in terms of project economics.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like in all these other jurisdictions, the host country or host government actually had a pretty fair amount of data about the project that was publicly available, not only to the legislature, but members of the public, and they could inspect that. They might not get the private companies or the corporations' projections per se, but they could come up with their own projections. A person at home that isn't in the legislature or anything else could look at those and put in their own assumptions and come up with conclusions. And we're really, at least right now, we have no ability to do anything even remotely like that. Is that an unusual situation to be in these other countries you're looking at?
So I think, Senator Klayman, through the chair, I mean, just to be clear, typically these open book economic models aren't available to the general public or indeed to other stakeholders, because, you know, I'm sure AGDC and Glenfarne would reflect the same sort of commentary that, for example, if you're dealing with an LNG purchaser, you don't necessarily want them to have full visibility into the project economics. Likewise, if, you know, talking to lenders or a whole series of other stakeholders. So typically there are, you know, fairly material confidentiality constraints that exist around these, but ultimately they are designed to give key government stakeholders sufficient visibility to have confidence in the decisions they're making around tax and fiscal arrangements.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman.
Hopefully the last one. If you've got some degree of confidential information, do they just structure the confidentiality agreement so that members of the legislature and their staff and experts hired by the legislature have a fairly in-depth look at these things, but they don't have to turn that over to the public they don't have to turn to the public everything they looked at? How do they deal with the public process of being in governmental bodies?
So I think Senator Klayman, through the chair, a great example might be the mechanism used for SB 138. The Department of Law had a clear list of people who had access to that kind of economic data. Every individual on the list had to sign their own personal non-disclosure. So it was a rigorously controlled exercise. But I forget exactly who, you know, which senior individuals within state government would have had access, but there were a number I seem to recall.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions on slide 18? Yes, Senator Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So looking at slide 18, I was just wondering, do all of the places on the left have a government structure like ours, if one at all?
Thank you, Senator Rauscher. And through the chair, you know, the government structures in these countries, they're very variable. And indeed, the ways in which hydrocarbon development takes place is very different to Alaska. They're often production sharing contracts. And for example, with Mozambique, the LNG project there was facilitated through what they call a decree law, which is very different to the process that would apply in the legislature here. So the answer is it's very varied.
All right, thank you.
All right, Nick, I see no further questions, but I also see that this is a logical breaking point. The next section is about surcharge implications. So what I'm wondering is if you could be available next Monday. Certainly our next meeting is on Friday, but we typically are missing members on Fridays. So it can sometimes limit the information getting to members. I'll just ask committee members now, who's planning to be here on Friday?
For today, I'm here.
So. Okay. So for the most part, everyone's here. Would you be available on Friday, Nick, to continue starting on slide 19 then on the surcharges?
Yes, Chaggy's like I could attend the committee on Friday.
All right. So at this time, we'll stop here then and have Mr. Fulford and Mr. Rollo back again on Friday for a continuation of this presentation. So at this time, we We will adjourn the meeting. There are other bills scheduled for Friday. I will modify that list, and if we have time, we'll hear those pieces of legislation. But at this time, we will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:55 p.m. I would ask committee members if you have specific additional questions, if you would email them to me, I'll send them forward to Mr. Fulford just to answer specific additional questions. Thank you. We stand adjourned at 4:55.